It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And away we go, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all here on this Saturday morning for the first running of this show. This show was recorded beforehand because this morning is the start of rifle deer season here in Alabama.
And probably not too many people listening to us right now, unless they're in the deer stand.
But there's a lot of people who don't deer hunt, so that's why we're doing the show this way. I know it's hard for you to understand this, and it's hard for me.
Who doesn't deer hunt that we know?
The best fishermen we know on the inshore world.
Well, there's a few of those. Yeah, there's just a very few of those.
They don't stay after the deer hunting as much as us. But yeah, so deer season starting. Of course, rifle season across the state today, and we'll talk more next week about that and get results here. Finally, I will say this. I finished up, Mike, Sunday afternoon, got the last of everything, cultipacked everything, fertilized everything.
You hit it just right.
I hit it just right. So I got to strut around a little bit. Your stuff planted?
I planted it last Wednesday or Wednesday before.
Yeah.
And then it rained Friday.
Yeah.
And then I had to go back up there Monday, and the tractor was still in the woods. I had to go take it back to my camp. And all of my seeds that were still left there that the hogs hadn't eaten were all germinating, every one of them. I could see they all had a little root coming out of it going in the ground.
So we had
in 4 days.
Yeah, and that's all it takes. So, yeah. Those of us that, I'm sorry for those who planted early. Those of us that waited later caught the rain right. Now we'll see going forward how it does, but right now we're good.
I think we hit it just right.
Knock on wood.
And it's more coming next week.
Yeah, so there's that. And but we start the show because it is opening weekend of deer season. I figured we'd talk some fishing.
Sounds good to me.
Makes complete sense. And it's great to get this guy out. Known him for a long time. Great guy. But the first time on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, Captain Richard Rutland from Cold Blooded Fishing. Welcome aboard.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. Y'all got me smiling ear to ear over here talking about the opening day of deer season.
We know you love it.
Hopefully going to have some folks off the water this weekend. I've got a full guide schedule this weekend. So,
well, it works, yeah. Like, and I know that those of y'all, like you and Bobby are always saying, like, oh, hunting season, okay, that's going to be a production. It's like even in spring fishing, the joy that y'all have about turkey season is amazing because it gets a bunch of us off the water and spring fishing too. So it's a good deal. So yeah, there's a lot to talk about in the fishing world. Great to get you on the show. And I think overall, let's kind of get your backstory too. When you got into, first of all, and on this Veterans Month, thank you for your service to our nation in the Navy.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. And we appreciate that. We all appreciate that. You do that. You were on boats and you said, hey, when I get out of the Navy, I want to get back on boats and stay there. How that happened? What was your evolution into being a guide?
My dad used to always say it, that I was a water dog, growing up, always around the water, always fishing. I remember being a young kid coming into your shop, Mike, back in the day, getting our fishing tackle and everything, and so just grew up on the water. Luckily my dad really just gave me the sickness for fishing. After high school, I went to college for a little while, to figure out I wasn't ready for that yet. went into the Navy, naturally just knew it would always keep me near the water somewhere.
Right.
And came home, started school at South Alabama, and while I was in school, went to captain school at night, and got my captain's license, and kicked off my career. I couldn't tell you all the stop and goes along the way to how I got to where I am now.
But you knew at one point, like, this is what I want to do. Like, this is what I want my job to be.
Yeah, I think when I was probably about 12, 13 years old, McGill Tulane, my alma mater, used to put on a fishing tournament, and they had a pro amateur division, and where you pay to go fishing with a guide, and to compete with the guides in their own category. And we drew Bobby.
Yeah.
To go. So I went on my first guide trip when I was probably about 12 years old, when I went with Bobby. And I remember getting off of the boat and looking at my dad and saying, I think this is what I want to do when I grow up,
Wow. So, I mean, that young, you're 13 and
know. Yeah, and he had me talked out of it for a real long time,
right.
And when I was at school at South, I was I think I started maybe in engineering school and decided I was not good at that. And then I went to business school. And then, you know, my wife kind of convinced me. She's like, I was kind of taking some folks fishing just for fun. Like, hey, cover gas and beer and bait, you know, and we'll all take you fishing or whatever, you know, with some friends from the JCs. And my wife was like, man, you're like kind of seem like you'd like doing this or whatever, you know, why don't you go get your license and try, you know? And I was like,
so, great woman right there.
Yeah, man.
I know. So I owe Miss Katie all the thanks in the world for that, pushing me in that direction.
So you get into this and you've made, you know, by sitting here where I am, maybe it seemed very quickly for you day in and day out in the grind, not very good, but you made a name for yourself pretty darn quickly, you know, with your ability to catch fish and then being catch those fish day in and day out for clients and guide trips and winning tournaments.
Yep. That it's a lot of hard work. You have to have a good network. You got to have a good work ethic. It's funny, you run into folks who will fish for go on a vacation or something and fish for 3 or 4 days in a row, and they're like, man, I don't know how you do it every day, you know.
That's a fact.
And I guess I just want it more than everybody else, you know. Right. And so it's easy to get up. I have a great office, you know.
Right. Yeah, but and it's something Mike and I have talked about many times. Those of y'all that are the best, even when you're not booked, I don't know how many days that is, when you're not booked, you're still fishing.
Oh yeah.
Versus there's some people in this business be like, okay, well, if I have a trip, I'll go. But then they're days and weeks behind what's happening with the fishing. Y'all go even when you're not booked.
That's right. Yeah, I have my customers, you know, when you have clients on the boat and you're trying to just get to know each other, like, man, what are you doing your days off? And I was like, I'll give you one guess, you know. Going fishing. You know, I was off today. We were doing a fisheries meeting over at Five Rivers, and I'm sitting there looking at the Delta all day thinking, golly, I wish I was out there right now, you know. Like,
and listen, think about those like us that watch y'all's videos and pictures when we're sitting here under the fluorescent lights in our office. We want to be out there too, so maybe that's a good place to start. Oh man, this makes me nervous even talking about, but Causeway fishing, it's been, you know, a guy that grew up fishing on the Causeway. I've seen a lot of changes, and the changes as of late have not been great to me. I it seems like that window, talking to somebody who's been doing it a long time like I did, said they said they started after the third football game of the year. I used to remember around Bayfest and going past Bayfest, I'd start catching fish in the Delta. That was October, early October. It hadn't been that way every year for the last 5 or 6.
That's right. We've been talking about this a little bit through the fisheries meeting I just came out of, but I think a lot of it has to do with the outflow of fresh water that comes down through the Delta now versus several years ago.
Right.
It feels like there's more fresh water coming down, especially I think it has to do with the Tennessee Tom Bigby River, because like I said in the meeting the other day was the Mississippi world seems to make the Mississippi River seems to make the world go round, you know, so it always seems like the Corps of Engineers trying to do everything they can to keep it in good shape, I guess, for all the shipping and whatnot, and which it, you know, it has its place.
Yeah,
but it's been really low too. The Mississippi River has been really low.
Yes, and I think that's why we're seeing a pretty good year in the Delta this year so far.
Yeah, and so but it's this formula, right? That we have this bit, we had a kind of a not record setting, but of note dry period, and saltwater makes its way up, but I've seen this before, Richard, where the saltwater makes its way up. The shrimp make their way up. But not that there's no trout up there, but they're not like they used to be everywhere in years past. This year is starting to get a little bit better. But have you ever seen those years? You're like, man, there's shrimp hitting the side of the boat.
Yep.
And there's not fish in here with them.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's when you go to scratching your head thinking, man, is the fishery in bad shape, or is it the freshwater, or things just changing and I just need to get along with the times, you know, kind of thing. But one thing I have noticed this year, it's Gulf-wide, the shrimping industry is in the tank right now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shrimpers all the way up Florida, all the way to Texas that are their boats are sitting at the dock. They're not going out and shrimping, and we're not getting domestic shrimp because the import.
Right. We did a whole show on that on the midday show, how this racket's being run that's putting our people out of business.
And so, and I have not seen, you know.
That's interesting. I've not, more shrimp.
Maybe. I've not seen the big shrimp boats this year that I have in years past. Usually, shrimping season opens up June 1
yeah.
every year. And, man, sometimes you look out the mouth of the bay and there's 40 boats out mm-hmm. there just zigzagging, crisscrossing all over the place catching shrimp. And you're not. I didn't really see that this year.
That's so a new thought. I hadn't even thought about that. There's like, just more shrimp.
All right. I feel like the effort is on that side of it is not near as high as usual. And so maybe that's why there's more shrimp and why we're seeing a better year in the Delta. Who knows? But several times I've been throwing my cast net for other stuff, for pogies or finger mullet or something like that, and catching netfuls of shrimp. And I'm like, dadgum, I've never seen this before. Like, literally never seen it before. All the way up in the headwaters of Dog River, throwing my cast net for pogies and catching shrimp. You know, you look in there with all the pogies and there's 2 dozen shrimp in there, and I threw like 3 times, you know.
So yeah, it's a thought. I had never thought about that. Just the human portion of it with shrimp and being down, that there are more shrimp in the mix. So what are you? So the formula right now, we did have the rain here that Mike and I were just celebrating for our deer patches, but it didn't seem to be a massive upstate rain that would shut this down. So we still have the salinity. We now have had some cooler temperatures. Like for you, what do you look for? Like that temperature in the water when you say, okay, we're going in that true fall pattern, or we're,
you know, like lately the trend is like it's chilled down a little bit and it comes right back up, and it chills down a little bit and it comes right back up. It hadn't like really set in just yet, so I wouldn't say like true winter or fall pattern just yet. We kind of keep teetering, maybe a little bit, maybe still of a transition period. But when it starts to get like in the lower 60s, that's usually like full-fledged, full-on fall bite.
But we're close to it.
Yeah, we are. Like right now, the water temps are in the upper 60s, upper 60s, 70 degree mark.
Okay, we're going to come back, talk more Delta fishing, but we're also going to go way offshore with Captain Richard Rutland and everything in between right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you along. And great to have Captain Richard Rutland, cold-blooded fishing, in studio. I kind of went straight into talking about Delta fishing. So I just ask you the general question you probably get, you know, at the gas station. So how's it been? How's the fishing been?
Man, in my opinion, it's coming right along. It's been very good. We're seeing what I would kind of call some old-school Delta fishing. Been a lot of birds working up there, seeing shrimp jumping out of the water in deep water, which is always kind of fun. Mm-hmm. So catch them on a mix of popping corks and grubs on jigs, and it's been wide open. There's been a bunch of redfish up that way already. Caught several bull reds late last week. So
that always gets your attention too when the bull red's in the mix and you're not expecting it. You know, thinking about different times in the Delta being thrown a rattle cork. And the bull reds come up and they're eating the rattle cork.
Eat the cork.
And you're like, oh my gosh, that's a big redfish. And then next thing, So the bulls have been in there too, not just the slots.
They have, yeah. We found some of those under birds, working underneath birds as well, eating the shrimp just like the trout normally would. But, you know, it's not one of those things. When I found the bull reds up there, and I found them 3 or 4 times already this year under the birds, and the thing is that the birds aren't – it doesn't look like what Bobby always calls the Alfred Hitchcock movie
of the birds
all piled into one little area. They've been kind of spread out, and if you pay attention, you'll see a bird or two get down on the water and grab a shrimp, and then you'll see like a boil, or when it's real calm, you can almost see the red up on the surface pushing, and I've – gotten lucky and thrown a couple topwaters in there and gotten them to blow up on the topwater. But that's the cork fine. Or a grub, that's worked just fine as well. But that's what I've been doing for the bull red thing. It's been pretty neat. There have been some big schools of them.
How about the trout kind of numbers and what about size this year?
There's been some really great size. We've caught some fish around the 20-inch mark up there, you know, which are like, you know, three, four-pound trout underneath some of those birds. That's why I said it's kind of old school feel of the Delta, because I remember when I first started fishing the Delta back in like 2007-08 time frame, you know, we used to catch 4 or 5 pounders under birds up there. You know, that's kind of been unheard of for a long time.
Yeah, that's the thing, having this come back is those bigger fish in there, and you know, and having them, we used to have them mixed in school, so we'd be catching measuring fish right? And then somebody catch a four.
Right.
You know, and then they were mixed together. I don't know what you're seeing this year. Are they separate? Are they mixed in?
No,
with
they've been mixed in. One thing I have noticed, you know, when you get back to the cleaning table and you're cleaning a few fish, you would think they'd be chock full of shrimp, but I've been finding a lot of little pogies in them too. And I feel like I had Dylan Keen, the flounder doctor, Dr. Doormat, with me one of those days when we found some birds, and he was throwing the slick lure in there, and he was catching considerably bigger fish than everybody else throwing a popping cork or a grub.
Now that's okay. Now that's something, because I love a slick lure, but if you and I are this time of year on the Delta, I'm going to choose a Voodoo under a rattle cork first, second, and third, maybe fourth, before I start going to, you know, I mean, as it gets later, I'm putting grubs on the bottom, doing a do-nothing drift, but I love a slick lure, but I wouldn't have thought about a slick till like on into December.
I know, and I took note of it, initially, you know, as soon as it happened. Uh-huh. It was the first day I'd kind of found the fish up there, good was with him, and I saw that slick lure thing, so I kind of had like three different lures tied on. I had, you know, like cork and voodoos tied on, two grub rods and two slick rods all ready to go. And sure enough,
catching big fish on the slicks.
Yeah, a little bit better fish on the slicks and the grubs. You know, the little fish react better to that cork, it felt like.
Right.
But and that's always kind of been the case, in my opinion. You get around birds up there, is to kind of get that lure down a little bit,
right,
with the jig, and you do a little bit better. But the slick lure really surprised me. Because that joker doesn't sink real hard, you know?
No, and people hadn't fished them either. Y'all, it's like a, I don't know if you can call it a suspending bait.
Yeah, soft plastic jerk bait.
It is going to eventually get to the bottom, but it's in no hurry to get there.
Right, you're only fishing an eighth ounce of a weight on the hook. It's an eighth ounce.
So it's a pretty slow fall. I mean, you go sit there. Yeah.
Are you able to get a limit pretty quick, or does it take you a long time to get a limit?
No, heck no. It's been pretty fast.
Pretty good. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah,
so fishing has been, I mean, that's how I'd kind of judge the bite. If you're able to get a limit pretty quick, then they're biting real good.
That's right. Not having to measure too many fish, it's been great.
Now, what about, it's all anecdotal because my life has been crazy lately. You have not been down there. Shame on me. But everybody I'm talking to said, yeah, Sean, but the white trout also have been showed up big time. That the white trout were like pretty good numbers this year. Mixed in, are they separate? What are you seeing?
I've been seeing them separate, but you are finding bird schools up there with white trout under them, you know, where it's just nothing but white trout. And there's been some hammer-sized fish up there, like 14, 16-inch white trout.
You know, I got to think, I don't know if we are, big yellowmouth white trout, one of my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Favorite fish for fish fries and all that.
Oh, yeah, they're real tasty to eat. And
got my attention now.
Usually when you find
14-inch white trout, you got my attention.
Oh, yeah, when you find them, they're usually piled up right down there on top of each other. And they're never shy to eat an artificial bait either.
No, they're good volunteers. Okay, and you mentioned redfish. We mentioned the bull reds early. What about slot reds? What are you seeing? Are they?
There are a few. I have not been catching a lot of slot reds. I haven't been catching slot reds good in a couple of years, Sean. It's, in my opinion, that is a fishery that is down. The bull red fishery seems to be in good shape, but we are seeing this nice bumper crop they kind of started out earlier in the summer being like 8 to 10 inch reds, little bitty rat reds, and now they're starting to get to almost legal size. And I'm hoping that we'll get another.
So they're almost doubling in size if they get to legal.
That's right. And so that's really exciting. And you know, throughout the whole summer, I've been seeing them like stem to stern in our system, all the way up to the Causeway, to Dolphin Island, to Bayou LaBattery. I had a couple of trips that I ran over on the Eastern Shore. We went to Magnolia River, saw a bunch of them. We're catching them kind of like everywhere we went. So seems like there's a lot of them around. Hopefully we'll get another crop of them again next year.
Yeah.
And, so what happened to the slot reds?
I don't know.
There was plenty of them.
That's right. Patrick Garmus and I have been talking about that, comparing notes over the years, and we kind of noticed that all of a sudden, out of the blue, we weren't catching the rat reds anymore. You're only catching the slot reds, you know. And so what's happening there is, you know, that you're not having good reproduction going on there with the bull reds. We've had some bull red kills I think 2 years ago there was a giant bull red kill where there's thousands of them washed up on the beach everywhere.
I remember that.
What was
your theory? Yeah, was it a
they suspect it was obviously a water quality issue.
Yeah, biological agent or something.
They suspect that it was possibly like a deep water upwelling where you get a current that comes from deep water and pushed up into the water column and made like an area of low dissolved oxygen. And bull reds are very susceptible to dying if they don't have oxygen. They're big fish. They require a lot of oxygen to run their bodies. So pretty interesting. But
yeah,
that they couldn't really exactly, the C-Lab, you know, I kind of helped trying to help work with them. They couldn't exactly put their finger on it, but that's the best scenario we could come up with.
Now, we could ask you about this. Sensitive subject, but flounder. as you got this thing, but are you taking any time to get away from bird schools and all that to see if there's any flounder here in the Delta? Are you doing any grub fishing?
Anything? Yeah, we have, actually. You know, I do about, I don't know, 15 or 20 days a year doing nothing but flounder fishing with the C-Lab. And
pretty darn good at it. Pretty darn good.
We always schedule a couple of days in November during the closure to go and see.
Which remind everybody it's released, yeah.
Right. And kind of see if we can start to pattern some things with their spawning activities, right? And it seemed like we went a couple of days into November and we went down and fished the south, like where we've been catching some great fish around Dolphin Island Bridge, Fowl River area, that kind of stuff. And couldn't buy a bite. All day,
really?
For a day, and then the next time we went, which was about two days later, we came to the Delta and started to find a few fish, and we moved over to the Mobile River and found even more.
And then for people to understand what maybe counterintuitive about that, if they're staging to go offshore, you think the bulk would be down to the south, not
right?
Still up, you know, up in the Delta.
So maybe our thought process is we always thought it was maybe a water temperature thing that pushes them offshore. Now we're starting to maybe think it's a moon phase deal because it was right after the full moon in October, at the end of October, and then all of a sudden they're all gone. But the other interesting part is that some of the fish we caught in the Mobile River are their ovaries are starting to get inflamed like they're about to spawn. And we caught some males up there too, some small males never get about bigger than 14 inches,
right?
12 or 14 inches. And
male was the issue, I think, right? That we didn't have the number of males in the system back
before. Right. Well, a lot of times you just don't catch those fish because they're too small to get the bait down or something like that, or you don't keep them. So, and the only way you can tell whether it's a male or female flounder is to harvest it, and to open them up and look inside.
Right.
So, anyway, we're starting to see like some pre-spawning activity out of the flounders in the Mobile River, which is kind of like it's just kind of like its own system,
Because it's deep for that's what I was going to say. So, is this idea because the flounder, would push out to deeper water in the Gulf, higher salinity and all that? But is that
they have all that right there?
That's what I'm saying. In that dredged area in the river, does it meet those standards for them?
We believe so. Because
that's crazy.
What the ship channel does is create what the scientists call a salt wedge. Mm-hmm. we've caught several red snapper in the
sure.
Mobile River this year.
I got pictures right in front of the convention center with snapper. Yeah.
Right. And so a lot of times the whole area could be fresh, but that salt water, which is much denser and heavier than the fresh water, will come up the bottom of the ship channel and stay into that Mobile River. And so, like we said, we kind of think that maybe there's some spawning activity going on inshore.
That's what's cool. I mean, the idea of them coming up that, below the Helicline there and being in the river, that's a cool thing. But this idea that they may be spawning there.
Pretty cool.
Wow.
Yep.
That is cool.
What we've seen in the past with the acoustic work was we catch a lot of fish, and we try to put the tags out, the acoustic tags, in certain systems. Like Dog River, for instance, we tag some fish in Dog River, and looking at the data, we can see the fish go hit Middle Bay Lighthouse or Gilliard Island, and then leave the gate of Mobile Bay and then go out in the Gulf. We see the fish come right back to the same rivers.
These acoustic tags, for people who don't know, these are tags that you can follow using what?
Right. So the tag itself is about the size of a AA battery or so.
Okay.
We insert that internally, suture them back up, and then they have stations that listen for the tag throughout the bay.
It's pretty cool stuff. We're coming right back with Captain Richard Rutland from Cold Blooded Fishing right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you here on this, opening day of deer season. So what we've done, Mike and I have gotten an early start on leaving to go deer hunting, and we recorded ahead of time a fishing show.
That's exactly what we did.
And we got, I've wanted to get this guy on the show for the longest time. It's so great to have Captain Richard Rutland in studio. and talked about. We were talking flounder. We were even doing the news break there. This idea, first of all, that the flounder might be spawning in the Mobile River, to me, it's just out of the world cool that could. And yeah, it makes sense. I mean, if they need 40 feet of water with high saline, you know, high salinity, then yeah, it happens there. You also were talking about some of the acoustic tracking showing how these flounder gather up and leave. We're finding out more and more every year.
That is, it's unbelievable what they're starting to be able to figure out with fish. What we're kind of talking about on the break here was kind of what Dr. Dormat and I, I keep calling him Dr. Dormat. His name's Dylan Keene.
Pretty cool, though. I
mean, oh, yeah. That's the coolest nickname that he could ever get in the world is Dr. Dormat, man. But anyway, what Dylan and I have been focusing on this year has been trying to catch flounder on the very top end of the salinity in the very low end. So we've been targeting, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, trying to catch fish in the Gulf in a really high salinity environment and catch fish all the way up past the Delta, past, you know, the interstate, the I-10 and the causeway to try to find a freshwater signature. And what Dylan is able to do when we harvest these fish is he goes in and get the otoliths out of the fish, which are his ear bones. And he can slice the ear bone, and you can see growth rings inside the ear bone like a tree. You know, just like a tree, if you cut a tree down, you can say, okay, yeah, this tree's 6 years old or whatever. So, and then what he can do after that is inside each one of those rings, he can do microchemistry on them, which is where they can go in and find the salinity, the type of environment that the fish was living in year to year. And they can see the salinity signature, you know, whether it was very high salinity, very low salinity, you know, and how that how the fish utilized the resource.
That's amazing.
It is. Yeah. It just blows my mind. They could tell you where a fish was when, you know.
And they hadn't cured cancer yet. I mean, golly.
So, yeah, but this signature, yeah, it shows that – so that maybe that fish lived more of its time up in the Delta or
more offshore, because there's also throughout this, you know, not all of the flounder come out of the Gulf and into the inshore waters where we're catching them. They're really hard to catch offshore, but you hear the spear fishermen do very well
on
flounder offshore. So there's a thought process that not all of them come in, and maybe we're kind of getting closer to figuring that out, if it's an age thing or who knows what makes them come in or go out. It does seem like we find the bigger ones, like what we call the big girls, later in the summer and in the early fall before they're about to pull out. And
are they big girls because they just get the bigger fish in, or they've had a summer full of time to eat and pack on?
I think the bigger ones are just showing up out of nowhere. Almost, I feel like the bigger fish maybe are coming inshore to feed real hot and heavy
before
they go offshore and spawn, because
they show up,
dude. They are such gluttons. You'll catch any size flounder this time of, you know, I guess this time of year, more like September, October time frame. Every single one of them you catch looks like it's got a golf ball in his stomach, you know, of some type of forage that they've already eaten. So they got a full stomach,
and they're still eating.
And they're still trying to eat something. It's
Mike, you and I understand that, right?
I definitely understand that.
I'm full, but I could eat that because it's good.
So what about all the flounder that they've released? Is there any way to check to see if which flounders come from the estuaries that y'all raised them in, or
you're talking about from the hatchery?
Yeah, from the hatchery. Yeah.
No, there's no telltale sign way to tell that. I have noticed like little imperfections in the fish, like, you know, you flip him over on his white side, there might be a black spot on it, and I don't know if that's natural or not or whatnot. And I'm catching a hell of a lot more flounder than I used to.
It's been something. I don't know what we attribute that. Is it the hatchery? Is it we just went on a cycle? Had a good. I don't know, but
closed November.
Yeah, that's my theory.
There's a lot of theories.
A lot of fish
that
don't die. That's therefore, you have more fish.
That's right. And I think just the overall reduction of the bag limit has really, really helped a lot. I think we're killing a lot more of them than we thought, because you got to think about this. You got all your recreational guys out there fishing. You got your commercial guys that it used to be unlimited, right? You had a hook and line license or whatever type of commercial license. It was an unlimited amount of flounder you could keep. Mm-hmm. Now it's limited to 40 fish per trip on a single license. The closure in November, I think, is a big deal because that's when they make their big move offshore, and they become easy pickings at that point. And then the hatchery is helping too. You know, the hatchery is really hard to tell, and we were talking about that as well. They're trying to figure out some type of way to put some type of signature in those hatchery fish so that they can tell that they're hatchery fish down the road. To see how much that's helping, you know, because there's some theories out there that only 1% of the however many that they're putting back in the water are making it. You know what I mean?
So but there's no way to quantify that.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. So that's hard. That's hard to tell.
Yeah. You turn about and then you go, oh yeah, well this one was, or what? If they were just bigger, we could brand them. Okay, you know, put a brand on them. But,
maybe put some dye on them.
Yeah, but put some red food coloring on them.
Well, you know, anyway. The other thing to think about too is the shrimping. You know, like we just got to talk about, there's no shrimp, not as much shrimping going
and
on.
Even and if you're pulling a recreational net like I do, the number of not just hog chokers, but regular flounder you catch in net, it's a lot.
Oh yeah, it is for sure, and every one of them dies. I'm pretty sure. You know, after the time you drag them, however long you're dragging them,
right. So there's things contributing. Hopefully, it just continues to build because we went in a pretty tough place there on flounder.
It's
good to know we have good
and the
news.
Gigging effort too has drastically
increased.
Come up. Every time you turn around, you see a guy with stadium lights on his boat driving down the road. So, not that I have anything against any of the ways to take a flounder, but but just the fact that those guys can't go keep 100 a night, you know.
Right. Yeah, 40. And the November thing, I think back to when I used to, I gigged a lot, Mike knows, years ago, pretty regular and light array on my boat and all that. And October, November, I gigged a lot of flounder, man.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of big flounder. I mean, that was a time that big, thick ones, you know, so it's.
Yep. That's the time of year that I've always caught a great big one. The past 3 or 4 years, you know, we caught one this year that was, almost 8 pounds.
Insane.
24 inches long.
A little halibut.
It was.
The biggest one I've ever caught, gigged, whatever, I gigged it at Little Dolphin Island in November. It was cold, but we was gigging, and I gigged one 7 3/4 pounds. Now, that's a monster.
That's a giant.
It is. Yeah. So, you know, you catch one, 7 3/4, 8 pounds, that's a monster.
Oh, yeah.
Now I want to switch gear. Let's go out the mouth of the bay, just like those flounder are, because I got to pick your brains. First of all, ling fishing this year, how was it? What do you think?
I would say it was great.
Great.
It was really good, especially kind of earlier in the year. I guess like the May, June, July time frame, it was pretty automatic out offshore. Seemed like everybody that was going like snapper fishing was catching one on following up some fish or go out there and hit the ship anchorage and did real well with it.
Last year, like the year before last, was good to me too. But I didn't really get to get on ling much this year. But people said it was even better this year.
Yeah, I would say the past. Probably 2 or 3 years have been very comparable in size and numbers. It's been unbelievable. You know, we were kind of talking about that with Scott Bannon the other day. It kind of irritates me some when, you know, you see these regulation changes with no science behind it. And that was one, Cobia was one, Ling was one of them where there's not really been a survey done.
But they did reduce the.
But they did, yeah. And it was just because there was a bunch of Karens fussing, you know, because they have got their, 70-foot boat, you know, Vikings out on the beach and they're in their nosebleed tower and they can't catch them how they want to catch them, you know.
Right.
They're obviously doing something different. Because
and maybe the ones that stayed close to the beach at the second bar, those all got caught. It doesn't mean the whole population got caught.
Right. I mean, nobody's catching them on the beach anymore, but yet we can go and have 20 fish days out, you know, right offshore off of Alabama all summer long, just about, you know. So they're just doing something different.
Right.
And we don't know what that is. So they're obviously coming. They're showing up, living here, and then leaving and going somewhere else.
Right.
But they're not doing their normal pattern. And we went and changed the limit, you know.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't pin that all on the state of Alabama. It wasn't all done by the state.
Right.
It came from the federal
level. Yeah, being a pelagic, being a migratory.
Correct.
Yeah. They're going to, yeah, because that's the thing, too, when you deal with that. It's why, you know, I believe so strongly in state management of reef fish. It makes sense. You know, they're generally homebodies. But, yeah, you deal with a ling. We got it for part of the year, but it's doing something. It's leaving, and it's under somebody else's rules somewhere else.
That's right. We, Crystal Hightower and I tagged one that I think got recaptured somewhere in South Florida.
Yeah.
So they're obviously, you know, they make some big moves.
There's a lot we don't know about fish, period. We were talking a couple weeks ago about tarpon. I never knew tarpon would just cut straight across the Gulf, say from Gulf Shores straight over to Southwest Pass or something. I've never seen them out in the middle of the Gulf, and I didn't realize they'd go in 500,000 foot of water.
That's right.
I had no idea.
I heard y'all talking about that on a previous show. Yeah, I think I was with Dr. Powers.
Yeah, it was.
And that is amazing. And I've seen some of those plots where
That's what I'm talking about.
And they're all, you know, it's cool. You look at fish, or like humans, or get like individuals. Some do the thing that brings them past Carabel so we can go fish them there and all that and then come down the beach. And then some just go, I'm gonna cut it straight across.
Yep. Yeah.
And some do some variety of in between.
Right. Our inshore species do that too. I've had redfish swim to Pensacola or to Biloxi or whatnot, you know.
And you're like, what got into that fish?
I know.
There we go. All right, coming right back, more with Captain Richard Rutland right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right now, without delay, in the last segment here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors with our guest, Captain Richard Rutland from Cold Blooded Fishing. We talked some ling fishing. We talked inshore as well. The reason for this whole interview is for me to get you in here to talk sword fishing. It's at daytime sword fishing at that, and your success with that. Talk about how long have you been doing this, chasing swordfish?
Probably about the past 4 years or so. It's either an absolute blast or you are bored to death all day.
Absolutely. You know, well, that's bill fishing, period.
Agreed.
Yes.
Agreed.
But this is, I mean, like growing up, I didn't do a lot of blue water fishing growing up. But I always was told, well, you got to go at night. You go at night and get the glow sticks and you do the sword fishing. And then here's this thing changing, this daytime sword fishing. What changed? Is it the electronic? Why are more people doing that now than before? What do you think?
Well, the guys who pioneered this whole thing are down in South Florida, a guy named, you know, everybody likes to talk about Nick Stanzik. His folks own Bud and Mary's down in Alamorada.
Okay.
And so he was one of them. And another guy, RJ Boyle, down in South Florida. And these guys figured out how to do it. And I don't know exactly how they figured out how to do it, but just with our technology of braided line and a lot of what goes into sword fishing is having the right rod with the right amount of tip in it.
Because the difference is, for people kind of unexperienced on this, nighttime was the right time because fish came up.
That's correct. Yep.
To what, a couple hundred feet?
Or? Yeah. When you have lots of illumination of the moon at night, like if you're on a full moon, you can catch them anywhere from 500 feet all the way up to the surface to 50 foot.
Okay.
And less moon, you know, maybe 300 foot to the surface
But that is shallow in comparison to the depth at the bottom that you're fishing.
Correct, yeah. We're fishing probably a minimum around here, you know, 1,100 to 1,200 foot of water, maybe 1,000 foot of water, all the way out to 2,000 foot of water.
So that's why that gear is important, because you're just at braided line, getting down to them in the daytime.
That's correct.
Reels didn't used to hold enough monofilament to do that.
No, heck no.
Yeah.
So that's it. Is a lot of the technology has come along with braid, and you have to think too when you're dropping that deep, that much weight and everything. There's a ton of scope in your line, so the smaller the diameter, the less the drag. And when I say scope, like, you know, you could be where your boat's sitting, your bait could literally be 200 foot behind the boat. When you looks like it's going straight down, it could be 200 foot behind the boat, right? Because there's scope.
Right.
And you have to deal with current and all that, figuring out how much weight to put on there.
But you're talking about, here's the thing that gets me, is focusing in on the spots to find them, because you start getting in that water. Like, what do you, it's just, It's a needle in a haystack, yeah, man. I mean, yeah, there's a swordfish and there's this giant area of deep water.
Right. It's kind of like it's kind of like bottom fishing, how you would think about bottom fishing to a degree. It's much more technical than just dropping a hunk of bait down on the bottom. But you're looking for those same things. There's lots of current out there, and so these fish are they're almost kind of like how a speckled trout would set up on a sandbar or in a trough or something on the beach. Okay. You got water movement coming over, and it's either dropping down into a ditch or it's hitting a little hill and pushing.
Even though this has happened 1,000 feet down,
right? Yeah. And it's pushing water up, and those fish are sitting right around there, just sitting there being ambush predators, waiting on something to come by, and then taking a whack at it.
So I mean, it is. I mean, you're looking at your electronics and figuring out this is the spot we're trying to drop on versus just saying we're just dropping because we're in the general area.
Right. And you can do that like at nighttime. You can just get in a general area and throw your baits out and drift. But with electronics these days, you're getting very, very accurate, clear picture, bathymetric views of the bottom where you can see where there's little humps and bumps on the bottom.
That are those ambush spots you're talking about.
Right, that are in 1,200, 1,800 foot of water. And so you're able to target those areas. And it's funny, man, you know, some areas get hot and then they'll get cold and another area will turn on. But there's lots of stuff like that to fish around here.
It depends on your electronics, too, is to watch, seeing your bait down there, seeing all the squid and stuff. A lot of people are just riding around seeing big schools of squid on the bottom, 1,200, 1,400 foot of water, and putting a bait on that.
Right. So yeah. Thus far, I've been doing what we call fishing blind. I've never had electronics on a boat where I could see the bottom that well. You have to have pretty much, I don't know about a 2,000 watt transducer, but most of the guys who are real serious about it want to have a 3,000 watt transducer to be able to see down there, to see the bait. With a 1,000 watt transducer, you can see the bottom. You can see how deep it is.
Yeah.
But you're not seeing any
detail.
You're not getting any detail, you know. And there's I'm on a bunch of swordfish groups on the social media. And you know, these guys will send some screenshots in where they actually see a fish, you know, and you can tell how far it up is off the bottom.
Oh wow!
And try to get your bait in front of it, and a lot of people get those bites. Or some, you know, you'll see some guys that will come out to some of these areas, man. You'll see them troll up one side and troll down the other. When they don't see the bait, they pick up and they gone. You know,
that's so, right. With their good electronics, you can see that.
Oh
stuff.
Yeah, with the way boats are these days, man, you know, you can hit one area and go be 30 miles on down the hill in pretty short amount of time.
Right. But you know, for those who don't have those, just the fact that like the blue chart and all that stuff we've added to, for doing deep dropping, I've added to my machine. It does. I don't see it, but I see where I am over something that's one of these.
Correct.
Ambush points or something like that.
Correct. And that's what you're looking for when you go out there. It's just some type of, you know, like I said, a hump, bump, trench, some rocks, some things like that that are real deep, like that is where those fish are going to be. And they're usually, you know, there's a lot of the stuff that's what I would call too deep to fish. You got to find that right water depth, which I always say is like that, you know, 1,100 to about 1,800 foot of water.
All right, so let's do this before we wrap up today. If I want to get a trip booked and go with you fishing swordfish or fishing flounder and trout, how do I do this?
It's coldbloodedfishing.com, or you can find us on social media at coldbloodedfishing.
All right, so coldbloodedfishing, go there and say, hey, I want to go. I mean, because you're like a lot of guys are just all offshore, all inshore. Like you do a mix.
Never a dull moment.
Yeah, but so you get people requesting, like they're going to say somebody wants to go on a trout trip with you, but somebody else may want to go offshore.
That's correct.
All right, this is a good thing, and no wonder. And then when he's not booked, he's still out fishing.
Oh, yeah, no fish
is
safe.
That's my man.
That's good stuff. All right, we'll do it all again next week. Here at FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Remember, you can check out this show as a podcast. It's pretty darn popular. It gets posted up later on today. And, of course, the show, if you're listening to us on Sunday or late on a Saturday night, you can catch it there as well. All right, y'all have a happy Thanksgiving.